Law, Policy, and Markets. I'm Alan Marks. Today, I'm joined by Matt Brown, a partner in Milbank's Project Energy and Infrastructure Finance practice based in London. Let's get to it. Renewables are forecast by 2030 to increase to 60% of power generation in Europe and nearly 40% in the US and China, according to Standard & Poor's Platts. Impressive as that sounds, renewable power generation still accounts for less than one-fifth of total global energy demand. Vast sums of capital are being deployed in new energy investments and to decarbonize other sectors like heavy industry and transport. Three interconnected drivers are accelerating the energy transition away from fossil fuels toward renewables and other decarbonized sources of energy on both sides of the Atlantic. New regulations limit or discourage greenhouse gas emissions. Government policies and tax credits are stimulating investment in renewable energy and newer technologies like green hydrogen, battery storage, advanced nuclear power, and carbon sequestration. And market forces encourage investment in green energy as long-term equipment costs fall and the risks and volatility associated with vulnerable fossil fuel supply chains and climate risks become more evident. Headwinds remain, including inflation, rising interest rates, tighter liquidity in credit markets, a shortage of skilled labor in many places, and ambivalent politics around the speed and direction of what is at its core a fundamental shift in how the planet generates and uses energy. Here to talk with me today about the energy transition and the state of the market in the United States, the UK, and Europe is Matt Brown from Milbank's London office, who, like me, is a partner in the firm's energy and infrastructure practice. Matt, thanks very much for taking the time to get together today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. We were talking and have talked quite a bit for a while about decarbonization and the energy transition and what's happening on both sides of the Atlantic. And I kind of want to get your take on that, because to some extent, it's moving in fits and starts. There's this longer-term narrative where certainly we are moving toward decarbonization, not just in energy generation, but also in how energy is used in industrial processes. There is still an explosion of investment in wind and solar, but now also in, I think, new, more novel technologies, hydrogen, energy storage, batteries, battery metals, and so forth. What can I get your take on what you're seeing from the UK or European side? Maybe see how it's different than the United States or elsewhere with respect to what's happening with the energy transition. What are you seeing?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're seeing a really large number of projects coming to the market, and I'd say they fall into largely two categories in terms of projects that are being developed and financed in the European space. First of all, you've got the projects that really are true novel and new technology. And I'd say a great example of that is in the battery space, for example, and anything up and down the battery value chain where there is truly new technology that is aimed at decarbonization, changing the way we live, for example, through electrifying vehicles or using cells to take power off of electricity grids. The second category of projects that we are now seeing come to market are really those aimed at taking technology and using it to decarbonize historically heavily polluting industries or industries with high emissions.
So what's a good example? Green steel?
Green steel, greening the steel manufacturing industry. You know, steel contributes, 8% or so of global emissions. And so if you can replace the technology that has historically been used, whether it be coal or gas that's been used to create steel and replace that with hydrogen, electrification, digitization, etc., you end up with an entirely new ecosystem producing the same product at the end of the day, but with significantly lower emissions. So green steel, green cement, other heavily polluting industrial processes that can be revolutionized with technology effectively.
Yeah. How much of that is being driven by regulatory changes, government compliance requirements in Europe, in particular for the European Commission, but also in the UK, or maybe national governments looking at some of the things? I know Germany's got some domestic policies as well, independent of what the EU is doing, that are fostering this. And how much is driven by real demand in the market for green outputs, green products, whether that's green electrons or green steel or what have you?
I think it's a real combination. I mean, if you look at who's funding a lot of these projects, there is definitely a big policy change from export credit agencies, commercial banks, that is driving the investment into these projects. There's also a bunch of new types of investors, credit funds and others, that are entering into this space that has historically, at least in the project finance space, has historically been dominated by export credit agencies and commercial banks. So a big range of available credit from different sources to that are all, from a policy perspective, really keen to foster energy transition, green energy projects, as opposed to conventional energy projects, oil and gas, etc. When you look at these projects at the customers who are interested in purchasing, whether it be batteries or green steel, green cement, they themselves have policy ambitions in terms of making their products, the end customer products that they are producing, whether it be cars or domestic goods or, you know, buildings or whatever that are incorporating cement, being able to market those as green and are willing, certainly showing a willingness to pay a green premium for the input products that come in for whatever they're producing for the market. So you take the sort of the sources of credit, the ambitions of the customers for these projects, and then you combine that with what is being done from a policy perspective in Europe, as you mentioned, you know, the European Commission, individual countries that are putting in place incentives, grants, other benefits that are fostering, you know, a real interest in this space and a real growing demand for these types of projects. But it'd be interesting to understand as well from your perspective the flip side in the US, you know, with the advent of the IRA and other regulatory change, how you see that sort of from a compare and contrast in the US.
Yeah, it's interesting. The IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, which was enacted really by President Biden and the Democrats, unlike the prior bipartisan infrastructure law. But if you take the two of them together, you know, there is a cumulative shift, I think a radical shift in some ways in US policy in favor of industrial policy that kind of comes through. There's also, and this is really more in the Inflation Reduction Act and probably more partisan, this desire to have meaningful climate policy coming out of the United States. And that really is focused on the energy grid and focusing on, in particular, stimulating investment in energy generation in a way that reduces greenhouse gas emissions. But they're two different things, and they do tend to get conflated in the bill. So the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, it does a lot of things. It extends existing renewable energy tax credits, the production tax credit or PTC, and the investment tax credit or ITC, which have long benefited wind and solar power generation to cover now other technologies. The PTC and the ITC have been extended for at least 10 years for electricity generation facilities with a zero greenhouse gas emissions rate. And that includes retrofitted plants that did not previously take the tax credits. I think this longer runway, this 10 years is already encouraging new investment, not just by developers, but also by manufacturers of clean energy equipment and components, and by potential new investors in tax credits or, you know, or tax equity. Under the law now, solar power plants can elect either the PTC or the ITC. And besides renewables, the ITC now covers also standalone energy storage, which is hugely important, biogas, and, you know, a lot of other things that reduce emissions, like microgrid controllers and dynamic glass and so forth. I wrote an article on Forbes last year when the IRA was first enacted. And, you know, as I wrote then, and I still think it's the case, in my view, the law really shows a policy migration away from tax credits based on different types of specific renewable technologies into credits based on emissions avoidance or reductions in a kind of a technology agnostic way. The IRA extends to Section 45Q tax credits for carbon capture and sequestration, CCUS, and also lowers the minimum thresholds or amounts of carbon oxide that have to be captured in order to qualify for the 45Q tax credits. There's new clean hydrogen incentives in the bill that are tied to reductions in life cycle greenhouse gas emissions rates. There's other provisions of the law that reward reductions in methane emissions, such as from biogas or agricultural waste to energy, and monitoring and control of fugitive emissions, which are tied to oil and gas production. The law is, to me, really kind of an industrial policy, as I said, as much as a climate-friendly energy bill. Now, the devil is still in the details for a lot of this. You know, there's bonus tax credits above the baseline amounts that are available if domestic content and labor standards are met, things like prevailing wages that have to be paid, apprenticeships that are required. There's also new tax credits for advanced manufacturing of clean energy equipment, though not for new transmission facilities, which I think was a miss and really would have been hugely beneficial had it been in the law, given how transmission constraints are going to limit some of the investments in renewable power that we otherwise might have seen coming from the bill. So, as I said, devil's in the details. The IRS is starting to put out guidance to explain a lot of the details of how the rules and the law are going to be implemented. We do have new clarity in at least one area already. Bonus tax credits in the IRA of up to 10% are available for projects located in energy communities, which are basically brownfield or coal mining communities or low-income communities where there are new facilities for wind or solar projects placed. And the IRS this month just released its long-awaited guidance on the bonus credits for clean energy projects that are located in energy communities. This covers areas with significant employment or local tax revenues from fossil fuel industries, above average unemployment rates or poverty rates, census tracts located near coal mines that have closed since 1999 or where a coal-fired power plant has been retired since 2009, and other brownfields. So I guess lastly, I'm working on about 3.3 gigawatts of offshore wind projects here in the United States. And the new Treasury guidance does confirm that for offshore wind projects otherwise eligible for the ITC, that they can still earn the 10% bonus for energy communities if their onshore facilities, so substations and so forth, are located in those neighborhoods.
Hmm. It's very clear that the European companies have absolutely taken notice of what's happening in the U.S.
Why do you think, I mean, it's interesting because there's plenty of opportunities to, this is a global industry. They could invest in Europe or Latin America or Middle East and North Africa. Why come to the United States if you're a European energy developer?
Well, I think primarily to take advantage of some of these benefits that are now available or expected to be available. The European Commission has certainly, you know, been highly aware of what has happened in the U.S. and, you know, has sought for clarification in terms of how European companies can have access to that benefit, perhaps without needing to be entirely in the US. So there's a lot of work going on in Europe at the moment, and hopefully some new announcements to come that will seek to react to what is happening in the US, to create similar landscapes in Europe, whether it be perhaps not through tax incentives, but through other types of incentives and grants that may be available either on a Europe-wide basis or on a, you know, the expectation, I think, is that there'll be more flexibility for individual countries to provide more incentives to projects within, you know, within their borders than has been available before under European rules.
I wonder, how much of that is a reaction? Well, I'll give a theory. I suspect a lot of it is not a reaction necessarily to the United States subsidizing renewables or technologies that reduce greenhouse gas emissions so much as it's a reaction to the domestic content and some of the kind of the national industrial policy aspects of our law, which is different than what we've done in the past.
I think that's right. And the barriers that creates for European companies, unless they are actually physically in the States and you know, setting up businesses here is challenging. So, yeah, it would be interesting to see what happens in that space. You know, we're seeing other changes recently as well that will benefit not just European or US projects, but sort of on a more global basis. When you look at, for example, some of the changes that have been announced recently by the OECD in order to allow export credit agencies to more broadly support green and transitional energy projects by allowing, for example, longer tenors, changed fee structures and what have you for projects. There's a lot going on in Europe and the US, but on a global basis as well, that hopefully, you know, will continue to ensure that these new technologies, new projects are able to come to market and find the types of financing that are necessary to see them be successful.
Yeah. I would say it's interesting for a lot of non-US investors coming into the US market. They don't already have experience here. Some of the we've talked to, I think there was a bit of a initial burst of enthusiasm when the Inflation Reduction Act became law, in part, by the way, not just because of the breadth of the tax credits that are available, but also the runway, right? Because previously, if you had a year or two or three to invest here before the deadlines hit, it wasn't really maybe justified to invest significantly either in U.S. development or U.S. manufacturing capacity if you're, say, an OEM. Now, with this law, we have at least a 10-year runway. So now it makes sense to devote the resources to this market and to invest. And, of course, the domestic content rules also favor investments in real manufacturing capacity, in job training, workforce development, and so forth, which will come from that. The trouble is when the non-US company shows up and tries to take advantage of them, it becomes quite clear immediately that we don't have the rules finalized yet. We're all waiting for guidance from Treasury on a number of these things as to the mechanics of how the tax credits will work, how to monetize them with the new transferability provisions, and so forth. So that's one thing. Second, you know, we're a federal system. And in all of these cases, you still have to deal with getting interconnection into one of the queues, you know, which are significantly congested right now for, you know, MISO, for example, or PJM, which together are two regional transmission organizations that cover a good chunk of the country, the Mid-Atlantic states and the Midwestern states. You know, there's thousands of projects between those two areas waiting for interconnection studies or reliability studies and so forth to be connected. And also for, in some cases, for there to be sufficient transmission capacity to be built so that their power can actually reach the market and reach buyers.
And what do you think of the sort of the time frames for some of those clarifications and, you know, information being available as to how projects can
proceed. Yeah, I'd break that into three pieces. First, I would say for the guidance from Treasury on the tax credits. So, you know, as I mentioned, the Treasury has already started to put out some guidance on some of these questions, and you know they have promised to do a lot more here in spring of 2023. They're, you know, for some projects, they're able to continue irrespective of that uncertainty. For others, where domestic supply chains may not be established, or where they're using technologies where the rules are not clear, you know, that may cause them to go a little bit slower. You know, but we'll see. But I think the guidance is coming soon. So that's the tax piece. I think the second part would be the interconnection backlog. That's going to depend in part on staffing up at the agencies or the RTOs that have to review those and the state commissions that have to review them. I think that's going to be a challenge because we just don't have enough qualified people on the payroll to do it. It's also, I think, in a lot of areas, you know, relatively new to figure out how to study system reliability and some of the economics around increased grid penetration for renewables. You know, in California and the West, they've been doing that for a long time, and they've kind of got it a bit figured out, and more advanced rules, and rules which are designed to create capacity markets or favor reliability, not just affordability. Other parts of the country, you know, the priorities are different. Sometimes cost is, and lowest cost generation is more important than reliability. So how do you balance those two? And I think, you know, to their credit, the grid operators are trying to seriously look at those issues before they just willy-nilly approve, you know, hundreds of new projects. But it does tend to create a backlog that's slow. The last part of it is transmission. And for physical transmission to be built, you know, you need approvals and money, and not all of the incumbent grid operators have the incentive to do that if they can't recover the costs of doing so, or if it competes with their own generating resources in states where you have vertically integrated monopolies still. So that's challenging. And because the Inflation Reduction Act does not subsidize transmission, there's also less economic incentive, you know, built into the bill to do that. So that will continue to be a logjam. Although the law does now give some ability for the federal government, FERC in particular, to sort of override or supplant state commissions when the state commissions are failing to approve interstate transmission lines. So there's a bit of a federal preemption in the law, and the mere threat of that could make some states approve transmission rights of the way more quickly.
Mm-hmm. And we've spoken a little bit, obviously, about what's going on in the U.S., what's happening in contrast in Europe. How about some of the neighbors to, you know, the U.S.'s neighbors, Canada, for example? You know, what have you seen as the sort of implications of the IRA and how Canada and others are reacting? There's obviously, you know, a lot happening in Canada, you know, in the battery supply chain in terms of raw materials, production and processing. To what extent do you see that those projects, you know, either can benefit from what's happening in the US or that Canada will potentially react in a way to address what has happened here?
Yeah, so Canada is really linked very strongly with the United States, traditionally, culturally, politically, but also, of course, economically and in energy. It's no surprise. I mean, Canada generates surplus power, hydropower in particular, that it exports to the United States. They're part of our interconnected North American grid. Canadian materials are an integral part of our economy, which we depend. I think battery metals are just the latest iteration of that, but we also import, of course, oil and gas from Canada and have done so historically. And the manufacturing sector, you talked earlier about how do you green and decarbonize, you know, heavy industry, especially where you need process heat, and where that traditionally may have come from coal and now could be gas, or maybe it'll come from hydrogen, whether that's blue hydrogen or green hydrogen remains to be seen, depending on where you are. But I think a lot of the transnational companies that manufacture on both sides of the U.S.-Canadian border will be approaching it as more of a holistic market. Now, obviously, in Canada, there are some different regulations that will take place different than in the States, for example, on disclosure requirements for climate-related impacts for greenhouse gas emissions, scope 1, scope 2, maybe even scope 3. That will evolve differently. But the kind of the holistic way that manufacturers approach their supply chains and the way that crosses the border, I think is still tending toward the green decarbonized investments that you would expect to see. And certainly Canadian mining is going to benefit from that. Two things about Canadian mining that are interesting here to me. One is, what are you mining, right? Are you focusing on, you know, oil sands in Alberta, or are you going to be mining cobalt and lithium? That's one piece. The other one is, how do you mine? Because greening of mining is also, you know, a global phenomenon. And you look kind of the ESG concerns around the mining industry. So labor practices and other things become part of it. And Canadian companies dominate a lot of the mining sector, not just in Canada, of course, but globally, from, you know, Africa to Papua New Guinea. So what they do when they add, for example, solar to a mine or a mining project instead of using fuel oil in, say, Chile, in the Atacama for copper. Mm. Well, if you're in Australia, if you're adding solar power or using biofuels for your heavy equipment, you need more batteries, you need more battery metals. It generates more demand for that product, but it also displaces otherwise very polluting diesel oil or coal or other things that you might have used in those remote sites. It's complicated. So let me ask you then, too, how this bumps up against energy security. So it's a complicated relationship. In the United States, we are now the world's largest oil producer, and we are exporting natural gas. The fact that Russian gas imports into Germany and the EU more broadly have been curtailed due to the Ukrainian war has created opportunities for U.S. LNG exports into Europe, which helps support gas prices that here otherwise might be dropping more than they have. There's a question of whether you can, on the one hand, afford to decarbonize and shift, say, to a more renewable heavy grid when you suddenly need to invest in, for example, importing LNG in Europe. There's also the question of maybe you must do it because the fragility of global fossil fuel supply chains points out the advantages of relying for your power where you can primarily on resources that don't require you to import fuel.
Yeah, and I think that's very much the heart of the transition in energy transition. There is an ongoing need to continue to for some reliance on fossil fuels, particularly in light of what has happened with the war in the Ukraine and other sort of regional matters. In Europe, we've seen an advent of new LNG import terminals, an absolute sort of necessity in terms of bringing down energy prices, but also allowing access to fuel to continue to power the grids. It's been interesting because that sort of increase in activity has been coupled with a corresponding increase in activity in the green energy space, looking at more renewable power, looking at alternative fuels, or whether nuclear comes back in as part of the equation as well. So yeah, it is very much its transition. It's not all green or all conventional energy. It'll be a sort of a combination, and perhaps in the longer term, a move to more sustainable and green technology. But in the short term, we need to combat the realities of what's happening in the market and the need to keep the lights on.
Is there a risk that this necessary investment, for example, in gas import and gas storage, gas transportation infrastructure in Europe now could lead to a concern about stranded assets or stranded investments such that it could delay the green transition later?
Not sure. I think the need at the moment is absolutely for this infrastructure to be built in order to, as I said, to keep ideally the lights on and energy prices lower. That is definitely the focus at the moment. Whether in the long term some of those will be repurposed or reused for other greener projects is to be seen.
I was struck by the success of it in many ways, because I think when the Russians' gas supplies were first interrupted, certainly when the Nord Stream pipelines were damaged physically, so not just the politics around it, there was this real question of would Europe be able to survive the winter? And this combination of LNG imports from the States, filling up the storage capacities, a mild winter, the temperature certainly helped, price caps, which were imposed by the EU, these different tools, both physically from a market standpoint, from a regulatory standpoint, kind of and a weather standpoint, combined to enable Europe to really to weather at least that winter, this past winter, very well.
Yeah, it's been quite remarkable seeing the infrastructure that has been able to be put in place very quickly. There's been a real focus on shortening permitting periods and taking a changed approach in order to address the realities. Also using different technology. It's a little bit going back to what we were talking about in terms of a lot of this is being driven by changes in technology, but developing import terminals that are based more around FSRUs and offshore equipment that can be brought in on a more sort of fast-tracked basis and plugged in with existing infrastructure, pipelines and grids, etc., in order to really plug the gap on a short-term basis has been remarkable. And we're seeing more of those projects at the moment in the market, sitting alongside others that are focused on decarbonization and greener futures.
Yeah. You mentioned nuclear before. I want to come back to nuclear first. Obviously, Germany historically has had an antipathy to nuclear power. France, although has relied on nuclear for the vast majority of its electricity generation for many years, has run into challenges given climate impacts on rivers and the need to curtail some of the nuclear production when river levels drop lower than they have historically been in the past. UK has an interesting, I'm going to say ambivalence, that's a kind word, schizophrenia perhaps, when it comes to nuclear power. Here we've seen in the United States, the Inflation Reduction Act includes a tax credit for maintaining generation from existing nuclear power plants. So it's a little different than stimulating new investment, for example, in renewables or energy storage. These are for incumbent nuclear generating facilities. They already exist. They're already producing, but they may be becoming uneconomic. So just as coal plants are retiring, and perhaps that's all to the good, we don't want to lose our nuclear capacity at the moment because it's too much of a critical piece of our baseload in many parts of the country. So this tax credit is meant to preserve that. On hydrogen, we've talked about green hydrogen where you use renewable power. We're also looking at some pink hydrogen projects where it's nuclear power that's coming as a source of generating carbon-free hydrogen. Is the role in Europe toward nuclear, you think, likely to be more favorable quickly, ever, soon?
I think so. There's a debate, absolutely, at the moment in terms of the extent to which nuclear power can be classified as green for the purposes of a green energy project. And particularly coming back to some of the issues I was talking about earlier, to the extent that you are producing a product that attracts a green premium, is that premium also available to the extent that the project is fueled by nuclear power rather than wind, solar, or hydro? And it certainly seems that that is a potential direction that we'll head in. It will mean that a broader category of projects can be classified as green and continue to foster the energy transition. We'll see how, from a regulatory perspective, that is addressed over time. But I do expect it will be an important part, and it's going to be an important discussion moving forward, just recognizing that a lot of these technologies require immense power loads, particularly the production of hydrogen and other projects that are either moving from using fossil fuels to complete electrification, etc. And if nuclear can be a big part of that mix, then it makes a big difference in terms of quickly we can plug the gap from what otherwise will ultimately be a shortage of power and higher energy costs that needs to be addressed some way to continue to foster the transition.
Yeah. Of course, too, so much of the conversation around decarbonization is we're moving away from fossil fuel extraction and combustion, but toward the need for more materials. And for nuclear power, you need uranium, and an oddly large amount of that is either being sourced or processed from Russia. So again, you come back to how does one deal with that? Yeah. Do we reopen uranium mines in the United States that have been closed for decades? And how do you deal with the environmental impact on communities, many of them historically overburdened by energy impacts? Those are very complicated questions.
And those sort of themes extend through into a lot of what's happening in the energy transition space in terms of diversification of supply, ensuring that projects are not reliant on single source procurement, whether it be from particular jurisdictions or from sources that potentially have issues from an environmental and social perspective, that there can be diversification there. And there is a big focus on making sure that for projects that are being built that have a reliance on raw materials, whether it be a nuclear project that requires uranium, a battery project that requires rare minerals, etc., that there is an expanded source of supply, and we're seeing more and more of those projects come to market in new jurisdictions. We mentioned Canada earlier. There's others in Australia. There's numerous jurisdictions elsewhere in the world where projects are coming to market either for extraction of the minerals from the earth or for processing of minerals, perhaps on a more sort of close geographic basis to wherever they're ultimately going to be used. And that's all a big part of the energy transition story at the moment, is making sure that there's that diversification of supply, because raw material supply is a big consideration for all of these, for all of these projects.
Yeah, with battery metals, even if they're not sourced in China, so many of them are actually processed in China. For solar, polysilicon very much, and as well as solar panels and modules and so forth, very much a Chinese-dominated industry. Mm. So thanks to that, we've got lower costs than we had 10, 15 years ago. But I think there is a tendency towards some deglobalization of those supply chains, in part for nationalist reasons, in part for economic supply chain stability. But that will increase costs, just unavoidably, I should think.
Yeah. And a lot of the focus, I think, in Europe in particular, will be on creating that ecosystem within Europe, either for the extraction or the processing of materials, to provide incentives to bring down costs, to allow that creation of sort of a diversification of supply in the longer term.
I want to look at one last area we haven't really touched enough on, other than talking about government subsidies and credits and so forth, and that's money. And where the money is coming from. There's a question now as to, with rising interest rates in particular to combat inflation, some of the financial stress we've seen in the banking sector here in the States, Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank come to mind, Credit Suisse, of course, globally, and their rescue by UBS and the Swiss government. Are we seeing fragility or a lack of liquidity in the markets in a way that suggests a credit cycle tightening to the extent that these otherwise fairly robust project finance credits are going to be harder to finance?
I don't think so. Certainly not in Europe. That's not what we're seeing at the moment. I think it's almost the opposite in terms of the number of, I touched on a little bit earlier, the number of lending institutions or credit institutions that are willing to participate across the capital stack, whether it be in equity, whether it be in a senior debt product or something that sits in the middle. So we are seeing an emergence of a sort of a second lien product category that is a feature of a number of the projects in the market. There is, I think, an ever-growing number of institutions that are participating in that space. We have seen a number of new export credit agencies that have come to market and are very active in this space, particularly across Europe, the European export credit agencies or the likes of other sort of similar organizations, multilaterals and DFIs. The, as I mentioned earlier, the credit funds that are credit funds, pension funds, and others that are looking to invest in this space, long-term investments that are focused on the energy transition and greener projects. Yeah, it really is the opposite, I think, at the moment. That's not to say that there won't be difficulties, and there are. There's a lot of considerations, you know, when we're putting together the financings for these types of projects. But there are a lot of interested investors who are actively continuing to look and are actively engaged in projects across Europe. How does that compare to the US?
I'd say it's very similar. So in the United States, banks traditionally have provided construction financing, mini-perm financing, generally shorter tenor, and expect to recycle those funds in order to have higher risk-adjusted returns on their capital. And most of the big players in that are amply liquid and their loan books are solid. Even for players like Silicon Valley Bank, which was a major lender in the community solar space in particular, not just in technology and emerging technologies, but in particular in renewable energy, their loan book was solid. The asset quality of the bank was not the issue. It was their liability and their mismanagement to their liabilities and their exposure on that side that were the issue. So I would still say there's plenty of liquidity and in some ways a flight to quality for the inflation-adjusted, diligence, risk-managed assets that are an asset class like energy or infrastructure. Real estate may be more exposed in other areas, but certainly the energy and infrastructure part of that asset family are viewed in the real asset space as being fairly stable and maybe some of the better places to invest. Non-bank lenders are not just prevalent, but expanding in the U.S. market. And of course, it's a global source of capital. So we have non-U.S. banks, non-U.S. credit funds, non-U.S. private equity investors coming in. The role that tax equity plays in the capital stack is only going to grow. And I think there's now, given the 10-year runway I mentioned before in the Inflation Reduction Act for the investment tax credit and production tax credit, there's room for more participants to look at providing tax equity in the U.S. market or to purchase on an annual basis with the new monetization and transferability provisions of the IRA. There's abilities for them to come in and do that. And tax equity functions in the capital as a mix between debt and equity. So if it weren't there, you might have less leverage. You might have more typical cash equity, or you might just have more loans and more debt if a project could support it with based on the debt service coverage ratios. The benefit of tax equity is you're really monetizing a credit from the government. So it is, you don't need to have the cash flows otherwise necessarily to support that additional liquidity. It's very helpful. We're also seeing financings on a portfolio basis or companies investing in preferred equity, mezzanine, term loan B, all sorts of different ways they can play into the capital stack that are not just single project specific, but maybe on a portfolio or a platform or monetization of operating assets in order to allow developers to sell their projects either during construction or shortly thereafter in ways that allow them to recycle that money. So although I think it's a challenging market for a lot of developers and sponsors due to higher interest rates, higher labor costs, higher costs of equipment, longer delays in supply chains, longer challenges on permitting, challenges on interconnection, all the things we talked about, compared to other areas where one might invest, it's still a fairly robust area and there's still lots of interest and the projects can, at the moment, still pencil out and support those cash flows that will support high leverage and therefore returns on equity that are higher because of the leverage, even though they're selling a commodity, which is fairly price constrained into a regulated market.
So we're feeling optimistic generally.
I think we're optimistic generally. Yeah. We really are. Good. It's been great talking to you today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Likewise. It's been fabulous.
Okay, man.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Thanks, Alan.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Law, Policy, and Markets, Milbank Conversations. Follow us on your favorite podcast platform and learn more at milbank.com.